Well, I was part of SLAM at the time, and I am currently working with Critical Resistance, and I have been doing organizing around the prison industrial complex, which is inclusive of police violence, prisons, jails, courts, surveillance, blah, blah, blah. Political prisoners since 78. I'm also using visual arts and my ideas, merging art, visual art, and organizing is an effort to reach the imagination and to, you know, to help us spark liberation via our imaginations, whether that's imagining PIC abolition or, you know, beings in the year 2078 with mouth in the head. And multiple genitalia. You know, I think it's the same word.
I wanted to ask you for a little background about, like, your years fighting the criminal injustice system, the prison industrial complex before the year 2000, and just, like, really briefly, if you could talk about what groups and what movements you were part of. Since 78?
Yeah. So I started organizing. Well, you know, my folks were activists, so were organizers in the 60s and 70s. So I had, and I came up during that period, so I had an environment around me that, you know, that really supported these ideas of revolution. And but then I got in high school and I got like, wow, so I kind of stopped, you know, being a little movement kid. But when I went to college, I started organizing primarily around Assata Shakur's case and a little bit around Desi Woods and Geronimo Pratt. And I was primarily interested, so I was primarily working around political prisoner issues, and I was very much interested in Assata's case because, primarily because she was a woman, you know? And as a black woman, I was really hungry to see, you know, folks who were like me, that I could, you know, draw draw some role models, people I could look at and see, like, okay, where are the similarities? So I started working on those cases, and I started working we started in an all-black, not just one all-black school, but a complex of black schools, Morehouse, Spelman, Clark, Atlanta University, and Morris Brown. So these are all black colleges in Atlanta, and there was not a National Black Students Association. And you wouldn't think there would need to be, right? Because, like, we're students, we're black, we're all here. It's historical black university, right? But the curriculum and the politics of the schools were so steeped in Eurocentricity and really bourgeoisie and really about maintaining, you know, the status quo, that we formed a chapter of the National Black Students Association. And very quickly after that, our chapter, which was predominantly made up of revolutionary nationalists, our chapter, all of us, became members of the Republic of New Africa, which, you know, I don't know if you know them, but part of the analysis, part of the program of the RNA, Republic of New Africa, is that black folks are a nation unto ourselves, and as a nation, we need land, we need culture, we need to be able to defend ourselves. And so the call was for five states in the South. And there's a lot of organizing going on in the South, particularly amongst black youth. And anyway, so I was part of that group for a long time, which later birthed Malcolm X grassroots movement. But at the time, there was no Malcolm X grassroots movement. There was MXP. And so in addition to doing the defense work around the political prisoners, we also did a liberation school in the black community. And we did some food stuff, and we did some, you know, various protests and that sort of thing. So, did I answer your question?
That's awesome. That's great. That's amazing.
And we had a newspaper. We were part of the newspaper. We put out a newspaper, worked with the newspaper that was coming out. So we were student organizers who were part of a national black radical tradition. So we weren't just like students who were, you know what I mean? Like, we weren't just doing a student thing. We were also tied to community and then tied to a larger national politics. So that's where I got a lot of my political training from. We had like dojos, and I remember kicking a cadre leader because I had issues with being too emotional, quote unquote, and not being disciplined, and he kept smacking me in my face to get me to be more like scientific about how to fight, And I was like, because I was always, the artsy one and, the bohemic one. And they used to be like, oh, yeah, you're a little anarchist. And I would be like, yeah, suck one. And they would be like, because at the time, that was like an insult, And so he was like slapping me. And so, I kicked him without form, I just kicked him, like, really pissed. And I made contact with his calf. And it was like I kicked this metal door. And my foot was sprained,
Oh, shit.
So maybe
God. The good old days. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. The good old days. Exactly. And we were a cadre group, so criticism, self-criticism, and, all the stuff that goes along with being a cadre unit. I left Atlanta, I don't remember what year. I went back to Chicago. Early 80s, and I went back to Chicago, and then I started working with Malcolm X, kind of forming a Malcolm X grassroots movement chapter in Chicago, and we started working with a coalition of folks around police violence, in particular the John Birch case. Remember that?
No. When was this? In the 80s?
Like late 80s. He just got I don't know what.
Oh, the torture guy.
Yeah, the torture guy. What did he just?
Geez.
I don't remember what he got, but yeah. Man, years we worked on this case, you know, and nowhere with it. You know, but
I remember some of the discussions we had in SLAM around like leading up to R2K, and I remember like discussing like, you know, all of us sort of really talking about what was going on in the globalization movement and stuff. And I remember you saying, I love the Black Bloc. And I remember, you know, some people were like, oh, fuck that. You fuck them. And you were like, I love the Black Bloc. And I was wondering if you could get into, like, why was that? Like, what were some of the things you loved? And what were some of the things that you were critical of about, you know, like, the whole, like, direct action focus of that movement that was emerging at that time.
Yeah. Funny that, you know, it's, I say a lot of shit, you know. And it's always interesting when it comes back to my Kamal was always saying that shit. No, you said, I was like, oh, really? Did I for real say that? Just kidding, just joking. My humor, you know? But no, I did dig the Black Bloc. And one of the things I dug about Black Bloc, right, was, I mean, I think the thing that everybody dug about Black Bloc, their fearlessness, you know? I mean, I dug that they were willing to go, like, move as if they had nothing to lose. And I mean, like, the critique of that is they were, I think, predominantly white. They functioned as if they were predominantly white. They functioned as if they had predominantly come out of a middle-class background, but I could be stereotypical here. I don't know. But that kind of freedom to say, I don't have shit to lose, and I'm going to, in this particular instance, I'm going to do what I came to do, which is disrupt. There wasn't a lot of hesitation. I didn't see a lot of hesitation with that. And I find that to be really refreshing, you know? I mean, even as an artist, like, you can tell when my strokes are hesitant, you know? I mean, like, I'm seeking a certain amount of freedom, and I think that's what the Black Bloc represented to me, like, the certain amount of freedom, purposeful. And courageous. I think the other thing that I dug about them was that they were tight, you know? Like, I don't know who Black Bloc was. Other people might now or might have then. I don't know. I didn't, you know? I mean, I don't even know if I really care. Like, I don't know if I was going around like, okay, tell me who's Black. Are you Black Bloc? Who's Black? And like, I don't know if that was even, I doubt, actually, if that was even a motivation. But I doubt that they operated in a very, they seem to be very clear about who they were and why they were there. And they seem to function in a way that, you know, seemed to honor that. Like, I didn't hear leaks about, you know, well, periodically I did, but for the most part, I didn't really hear leaks about who Black Bloc was, and, you know, and they had a cool, and the critique is they were cool, you know, and being cool brings with it a certain amount of, what is it called, the celebrity?
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were cool because they were effective. And like, in the Philly thing, in the Philly action, we would get somewhere and the shit would already been dealt with. I'm like, damn, the black cop beat us to it. You know? And then it's just like, boom, come through, you know? It was like amazing. It was amazing to watch, like to come into an environment with the purpose of disrupting this entire shit. And similar to graffiti, right? Like saying that this space is no longer your space. I'm taking this space. And to come into that space after Black Bloc had been there was to come into a space that had been, you know, reclaimed, you know? And I have respect for that. I still do. I have respect for that.
So you were in a flying squad on August 1st. What was that like?
Yeah. Crazy. First of all, I was too old to be in a freaking flying squad. I was too old to do tactics, even crazier, for a flying squad.
How old were you at this
time? Like 40. Mm-hmm. Like, really way too old to be doing this shit. I remember running from a horse. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? I'm 40 years old and I'm running from a horse.
Oh,
crazy. I'm retiring. This is nuts. As soon as I get away from this horse, that's it. You know, I would stop and be like, you know, and I'm a smoker. Like, shit, I gotta run from a horse to catch up with 20-year-olds who are, like, doing their thing, you know? It was great. It was great. Because, you know, I don't know if you remember, but SLAM has been doing a lot of, my work with SLAM, we did several organized civil disobediences around Mumia's case, right? And so we made these decisions that we were going to risk arrest and that we were going to go in. Inside, and once inside, you know, that there was a purpose behind that, you know, particularly as predominantly people of color, women of color, young people of color going inside with a political agenda was pretty cool. And I thought, you know, important in terms of making those kind of decisions at the time, particularly given that, you know, at the time when we, along with others, I'm not just saying with just SLAM, but we, along with other, you know, the more radical ilk, were being really critical of how protest was happening in New York, right? Because at the time, like, what was it, Abner Louima and different high-profile cases, the protests became pretty much, you know, they were spectacle, right? And so, you know, you can count on Sharpton to come out and do his Sharpton thing, and you can count on, you know, Channel 1 News and CBS or NBC affiliates coming out. I remember, like, before the Abner Louima case. Do you remember Abner Louima's case?
Yeah. He was tortured in Brooklyn, and then Aminu Diallo was killed in the Bronx. I guess mm-hmm. It was maybe a couple of years apart, but I remember them as being sort of around the same time, yeah.
Well, they were both big, very high profile, because Abner Louima was, I don't remember the chronology. It was either what's his name? Shit. Baez. Anthony Baez killed right before or immediately after Abner Louima. And the police were just on, like, some crazy pick shit, you know? Like, they were just wilding. And not that that's, you know, totally surprising, but, you know, sometimes there's a little bit more restraint with your shit. And they were just fuck wild. And with Abner Louima, like with Baez, Abner Louima, and many other folks who were killed or maimed by the police in New York, you know, the people would get upset, and the people would stage these marches, you know, and like with the Louima march, he was the one who was a Haitian dude who was tortured by, I forget, maybe it was 70. Anyway, it was, he was raped with a toilet plunger, and, you know, people were outraged, right? Haitian community really outraged. Night before this huge protest, you know, the newscast was hanging out in front of one of the kind of workspaces where people were meeting about the protest, you know how we do, and making signs and that kind of shit. And they were like, oh, we're standing outside in front of the meeting where tomorrow there will be a huge protest. I was like, this is madness, you know, like, what happened to protest, you know? Now it has become spectacle, and I really didn't see myself and others, really didn't see a distinction between that and, like, St. Patrick's Day parades or whatever. You know, it became like an event. And so many of us really kind of critiquing how protest was being framed decided to start doing direct actions and civil disobediences to shift that, you know, just to shift that paradigm. And so we, SLAM have been involved in some of these organized protests. And we had taken quite a few arrests, right? In Philly, around Mumia, like one or two, in D.C., in New York. Like, so we were all over the place getting arrested. And so at this time, we decided, a lot of us made the decision that we didn't want to get arrested, that we wanted to do more disruption than go in with an organized arrest, in this case, you know? And, you know, I had also been part of this other network, an affinity group of folks who were going around doing direct actions, mostly like billboard, you know, redecorations and banner dropping and shit like that. And so, you know, I was making like some pretty distinct and pretty clear distinctions between civil disobedience and direct action, right? And so being part of the Flying Squad was cool because it was an opportunity to disrupt business as usual, you know, and at the same time not actually intentionally put ourselves in the hands of the state.
Right, I remember that. I feel like that's always inspired me so much, and it feels somehow like more sincere in a way, but it's not, but all of our actions are kind of, you know, symbolic, but in a way it just felt like at least we weren't just trying to be symbolic, we were trying to really go for something more direct, yeah, I was always inspired by that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's a question. It's tactical. It's not a strategy. It's like, okay, what tactic works best for this situation, you know? And then, like, that's not to say that folks who made the, I'm glad there were people who made the intentional decision to get arrested, you know? But I think there was also a need for folks to make an intentional decision to not get arrested, and to continue to form some, you know, because even getting arrested, whether getting arrested intentionally or disrupting you know, in business as usual intentionally. It's all about, like, it's all about making a statement, and it's all about, again, you know, making some intentional decisions around disrupting business as usual. And I think, you know, tactics being what they were, that August 1st day of action, we made a decision that we wanted to stay out if at all possible and to be on the street more present than, you know, behind bars. So.
And you didn't get arrested, right?
Nope. Imagine that. I was like, oh, my God, I wish I got arrested because this court support shit, this jail support shit sucks.
Oh, man, you mean because of the decision-making process and during all the legal cases?
Oh, man, all of it. Not just that. I mean, the decision-making process is, you know, part of it. So that was the least of it. I think the most of it was that, you know, after a big action, you know, we did months and months of planning for this action. So you got months and months of sleepless nights and lots of travel. I'm just putting it on a human level, right? A lot of travel back and forth. For those of us in New York and other places, a lot of travel back and forth to Philly to do recon, to meet with folks, yada, yada, whatever. A lot of preparation time, money, the whole nine, you know. And so your adrenaline's kind of pumped. You're struggling with your comrades. You're, you know, trying to make sure you've got all your, you know, T's crossed and I's dotted, and then, you know, trying to keep your energy up and keep, you know, being inspired and inspiring. And then here comes the big day, and you know, you're pumped. Okay, here's the big day, and how's this going to work out, you know? I remember somebody, probably SC, squirting me with lavender. They're like, leave me alone. You know, like, I want you to be calm. I'm like, you're stressing me out. You're calming me and stressing me the hell out, you know. But, like, that kind of level of, you know, love and care and in all these different forms, right? And so you go out and, you know, you guys talk and ahead of time. I mean, just keeping it on a human level. And you got your little affinity group, and y'all know what you're going to do, but not really. And, you know, and somebody's annoying somebody. And, you know, it's all this energy, right? And then you go out, you do your thing, and then, you know, you're ready to go home. Like, I want to take a bath. You know, I want to reflect, you know, and, you know, we couldn't because people were locked up and, you know, we weren't going to just abandon our comrades, you know. So those of us who didn't get locked up had to be accessible and available and get our folks out, you know. And I think I was in Philly a total of like 3 weeks. So God, I lived you know, not only doing, like, dealing with the decision making and hearing people like an hour after, and I'm being facetious, but seriously, it seemed like an hour after people were arrested, they were like, we're going on a fast. I'm like, no, you know, escalate to that. You know, what the fuck? They're not giving us vegetarian meals and, you know, people's parents coming and, you know, trying to get lawyers and money and, you know, it was just madness. It was just really, really hard.
You were stuck talking to a lot of the parents, I remember.
Yes, I was.
Wow.
I was 40. And they were like, why do you have our kids asking doing this? I'm like, oh, God.
Oh.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So it was a lot. Yeah, I was in Philly for 2 weeks. Yeah, I think you stayed at my mom's, in the apartment, the empty apartment above my mom's apartment.
I did. I forgot.
I'll never forget because you needed a shirt and I loaned you my shirt that was like, it was like a picture of a bunch of people protesting police brutality. And then like after you left, I was like, she's walking down the street in South Philly. Like, I was like, I hope she's okay. Because not exactly safe.
I remember you saying that to me.
Oh, I just wasn't thinking. I was like, what is this shirt?
I was like, oh, it'll be fine.
It's like the neighborhood where they're like, you know, fry mumia and stuff like that. That's pretty
awesome. Yeah, I know. That's what you said, too. I was like, ah, it'll be fine. And I'm like... I think I was
so tired.
I was like, I don't give a fuck.
I'm just going to go and get our people out.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
It was a lot.
I wonder, like, do you think that, like, maybe some of the reason for the heavy hand of repression being so intense, do you think maybe some of it was because we were protesting police and prisons in particular and that we have brought... I mean, what was the decision-making that it was sort of like the global anti-globalization movement? Was it from the beginning planned to be around police and prisons? Or was that something?
No. You don't remember that?
I sort of remember, but I wonder if you could tell that story.
For the people who weren't there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. It totally was not. I mean, you know, and it's not to say that folks, you know, it was a political difference, you know what I mean? Like, it was a real political difference, and it was a good, in retrospect, a good, maybe not even in retrospect, maybe I felt that then too, that it was a really good political struggle, because a lot of our comrades, and I mean that, because in some respect, it ended up working well together. You know, we had to. But a lot of the comrades who were organizing these actions, particularly direct action, all of it, were really focused on dealing with anti-globalization, you know? And so, like, this was post-Seattle. And, you know, so there's a little bit of heat around Seattle. And when I say heat, I mean, like, energy, you know, in a good way, not in a, like, funky way. But there was a lot of energy and excitement around raising questions around neoliberalism and around globalization, and folks said, okay, this is a perfect time to continue this outcry at this RNC convention, you know? And then there were some of us who felt like, yes, that's true. However, we felt like we needed to link these issues of, global capital to conditions of people of color in the U.S. in particular. And we felt like one of the most, predominant, prevalent places to make that kind of association was related to the prison industrial complex, because you couldn't talk about racism, white supremacy, capitalism, and not talk about the prison industrial complex. So we argued that, you know, we can talk about globalization, and to make that kind of relationship nationally, domestically, we need to deal with the PIC. And you know, and it became like a real struggle because folks felt like in the anti-globalization people, not all, but some of the anti-globalization folks felt like, well, this dilutes our message. And we were like, no, what you're saying, to not privilege this, then, you know, further invisibilizes this struggle that we've been engaged in as colonial folks since we've been here. You know, so it was on and popping. And one of the things that, you know, really came out with that was a really, I think, some pretty heated and good conversations around sovereignty, self-determination, colonialism as played out in the United States, all that, right? So we got into it with folks around, like, how, and just to backtrack, I mean, what the folks who were really pushing for, you know, globalization, not dealing with national, domestic issues. One of the places that they really started pushing, what they offered was, well, let's just do an umbrella of anti-globalization. Let's have a mega mess. And we rejected that. We were like, no mega message. Like, cause, you know, no meta message. They wanted a meta message. And we felt like, what we were talking about, and particularly being in Philly, and particularly dealing with Mumia, who, as though, you know, I am critical of dealing with political prisoners as individuals, you know, in terms of the larger PIC struggle, and that's, you know, a political position that I've grown to over the years. With Mumia's case in particular, it seemed highly relevant that we emphasize Mumia's case. One, because there was a lot of international heat, again, in the sense of energy, interest in his case. Like, I had been in Chiapas at one point, and the frigging Zapatistas were asking us about Mumia. So there had been international attention around his case. And then also, I don't remember where he was in the process of, you know, at some point he had two death warrants signed. And so I don't remember if this was right before the second one or right after we had fought back the second one. Might have been right after. I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't remember. Or maybe in the midst of. But being in Philadelphia and to not, you know, privilege Mumia's case in this particular moment when the Republicans were pushing for more law and order, when the Republican or, I forget who was going for governor, but I think it was what's his face, who ended up being with, the Homeland Security, what's his name?
Ridge, yeah.
Ridge, right. He was like the governor. So it was like, wait a minute. You know, the conditions demand and also respecting the localness, like respecting local struggles. Respecting that people have, people in this city have a stake in some of these issues. We're going to also privilege the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We're going to privilege police violence in Philadelphia, you know, in terms of some of our messaging. So we fought like a lot around that. And eventually, you know, the resolution was, well, okay, fine. We'll have August 1st as a day of action around, you know, the prison industrial complex and listed out all these issues inclusive of Mumia. and other folks will take other days. You know what I mean? That's kind of.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my memory of how that worked out. But, you know, some folks just wanted to were not particularly, you know, quote unquote, signed up for a day. You know, some folks were just there because of the need to be there. You know what I mean? So not specific around like, okay, well, we're here for the PIC, you know, Day of Action. You know, some people were there through the whole nine.
For all of the
your questions.
Yeah, that totally does. I was curious because of I think what I remember most is the conversations in New York, and I wasn't sure. But from what you're saying, you were also like involved in the early planning in Philly too, like of the whole
thing. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Going back and forth and having those dialogues, and also, some of the stuff that we were saying is like, look, you know, we're guaranteeing that this, and this is, sounds like bullshit, you know, to even, like, say this, but, you know, whatever. It's part and parcel, like, let's keep it real. When you're organizing on some joint action, you're also engaged in a level of, you know, negotiating and, you know, I mean, there's a business aspect to it, right? And so it's like, all right, what do you bring? You know, that became like one of the questions, you know, and that's a legitimate question. And it wasn't necessarily asked out loud, you know, in such a, you know, crass kind of way, but that is a question. Like, if I'm going to be in a place of, here's a, movement lesson, right? If I'm going to be organizing some stuff, and if I'm organizing something where the stakes are high, in terms of, you know, morals, in terms of politics, in terms of the economy, you know, economics, whatever, wins, et cetera, stakes are high, and we're organizing a huge action, and you are, you know, really pushing for a particular direction, the politics of it. I'm not, you know, I'm not naive, you know, like there's a politics. And the politics of it are, all right, you're talking on a yak, what are you going to produce? Are you going to organize, right? So what are you going to bring to this? You know, what is your contribution? Susie Mouth, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, we had to be like, look, we are bringing what this movement does not have, which is people of color, predominantly young people of color, predominantly female-bodied people of color and queer people of color and poor people of color who are coming to this action from, you know, our own particular experiences, our own analysis, which is completely, you know, different from the analysis that is currently existing. And that has value. And you cannot talk about pushing for an anti-globalization. You can't talk about pushing, you know, for a movement that is about getting rid of diminishing exploitation and not deal with indigenous people, right? People who are most affected by these policies. And so what we're saying is we're bringing those folks' voice, not only their voices, but also their bodies are going to be on the line on this. So back the fuck up, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, that was the level. I remember I made one white boy, and I hope he's not here. If he is, I'm sorry. But I made him cry, and I didn't feel bad about it. I was like, fuck you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, seriously. So, you know, it was like, those were the levels of struggles that we were having. And what it meant then was that for us to be engaging in those struggles, it meant that we had to organize, quote unquote, produce some turnout, some people who were willing to do exactly that, put their voices, put their bodies on the line for these politics. And so, you know, it wasn't just talk and it wasn't just rhetoric. It was also like, all right, we got to come back and organize. And we got to organize not just for that particular moment, but we got to organize for the long haul. You know what I mean? And I feel really proud. That's one thing, as jacked up as that day was in many respects. I think one of the best things about it was the level of organizing that we did and the political education that we participated in this kind of experiential way in organizing this kind of an action, you know. And honestly, it really turned a whole lot of people off and it turned a lot of other folks on, you know what I mean? But it definitely,
yeah.
Really, it was a learning moment in many respects.
Yeah, people have told me about how, whether, you know, it was different for the folks who were, already, doing some sort of activism around, prison issues, or whether they weren't, it, like, people who were arrested and spent time in the county jail, it impacted their politics so tremendously. And I think, like, that combined with the fact that there was this political education around the importance of, you know, fighting the criminal injustice system, as we called it. I think it was right before we started saying prison and industrial complex, it was like, we were calling it criminal injustice system, right? Or, mm-hmm. But it was around that time that terminology was coming out. And, like, I think that it just that amazing combination of, like, people who are just getting radicalized in general and then becoming radicalized around prison and police issues and then experiencing it directly, just I feel like that kind of blew people's minds.
Yeah.
And, yeah, some people couldn't deal with it because it was so traumatizing, but I think also it made other people really make a lifelong commitment.
Yeah. And also engaging folks who had never organized with comrades or with comrades who had a different worldview and a worldview that in many respects could be identified as racist, you know, and to like, okay, I'm a work with this racist motherfucker.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm going to work with this person who is not intentionally racist, but who is embracing a lot of white supremacist ideology and behaviors, you know. I'm gonna organize with this person. Like, I think that was a huge learning curve for a lot of us, you know, who had not had that experience. And I think it was a huge learning curve for the white folks in specific, and it wasn't just white folks, but particularly the white folks who were embracing a white supremacist ideology and behavior unintentionally to have to, you know, check that politics, you know. So in many respects, I think it was, to me, that was one of the most powerful components of the process. It was a process, right, that was not always the product, the end result, but more frequently is the process, is the path, is the way you get there, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that had, like, a tremendous impact on people, even to this day. It had a tremendous impact on me, and I would almost guarantee for a lot of folks who were in those rooms, it had an impact on them in terms of their political development, you know? And that is, that was good. I think that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really valuable. I feel like, you know, that's partly why I wanted to do this interview with you, is just like, you know, if young people today really, you know, could also have that learning experience, even if they weren't there, you know, like sort of through, you know, what you just telling the story. And I think it's really good. I mean, especially like, you know, every once in a while I hear people say that, like, people of color don't do direct action or things like that, or like sort of mythologies around things, or like some, what issue is more important than other issues, or just sort of not noticing what's going on right outside their door in the city. And like, you know, really, prioritizing, global stuff over local stuff, that in a way that's not about, like, so much about solidarity as just like, just really not noticing what's going on around you right here. And I see that happening, and I feel like this story that you're telling is a really great way to sort of hold up some of the lessons that, you know, of what, you know, how to do things differently.
Like, one of the things that I think it's not youth specific, actually. I think it's a particular feature of our organizing. And so, you know, like, it would be stupid for me to blame the youth, because that would be completely unaccountable and not taking responsibility at all for my generation and my role in, you know, our movement. But as I see our movement, like, become somewhat popular, professionalized, popular, not in the sense like, you know, freaking, you know, tea party, like, say t-shirts and shit, but popular in the sense that, you know, there's a level of respect and cool points that you get for organizing, right? Or for being a quote unquote activist, which is a horrible word.
Yeah.
There's this misconception about, and again, you know, maybe I am old and jaded, you know, but I do think that there's a certain level of niceness and a certain level of bourgeois, which translates to me to bourgeois culture, right, that goes along with, like, let's not be confrontational, let's avoid conflict, let's be nice, you know, that has,
right,
like, filtered into our organizing. And that's not to say that we harm one another. Again, you know, I'm not advocating for, like, some of the, you know, self-crit sessions that I participated in where, you know, as a kid, as a youth, where, like, I was always in tears and shit, or got
right,
my foot broke, sprained, you know, but, I mean, because that's a little over the top, you know, or when you see your face on the cover of a newspaper and you're wanted for, as an enemy of the people, that's bullshit. But this notion of, because, you know, that kind of authoritarianism, I'm not advocating. But at the same time, there's this kind of fear of critique, fear of struggle, fear, that has seeped into our organizing, right? And so there's this kind of like, let's not piss somebody off. Let's not, like, we want to be friends. We want them to like us. We want to get cool points. That has really, like, impacted, I think, how we go into spaces where there's difference, and there's always difference. You know, it's not just, you know, physical, but there's always difference. And so what ends up happening is the expectations become really kind of naive, right? And so I'm saying all this to say that as young folks, young, whether in age or young in terms of struggle, go into doing this level of organizing, there is to be expected a level of distrust, right? Like know that. Know that there is going to be a level of distrust. And so that doesn't mean that should paralyze, nor does that mean that should be like, you know, like maintained or, you know, like trumpeted, but that if we make the assumption that, oh, we're all products of this, you know, society, and in this society we are taught to distrust one another, we are taught to see one another, we're taught to compete with one another, we're taught that there's this level of scarcity, and we're not, and individualism, like, to have that kind of analysis going into organizing allows us to make, I think, you know, allows us to make some different choices in terms of how we engage conflict and difference, right? Am I making any sense here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like it's really important. Like, if we don't have that conflict and debate, then how are we going to learn from what we're doing? I mean, I've heard people say, like, talking sort of about, like, press release politics, like, after every action, you announce what a great action you had, and it's like, you can't learn from your mistakes if you're not publicly, if groups like, you know, like, even groups around Philly, like, if we could just, like, be in a friendly way, you know, sort of criticize each other's work and give feedback and also support each other more at the same time, go to each other's protests, like, really be a movement. I really feel that would stimulate so much more development.
Right, because that's such an individualized notion, right? Like I can't be criticized? I mean, it becomes like, really? Like, what is that? Like, you know, what is that? I have no, that's such a individualized kind of approach. And it says that, you know, I have all the answers, you know, whether it's an individual, I a group, what have you, I have all the answers. I can't be criticized. To criticize me is to tear me down. You know, there's no way that we can really actually talk about building a movement. We can't engage in critique, right? Because critique is at the core of change. You know what I mean? And so, like, how do you actually continue to change, continue to grow, continue to reflect if there's no critique? And critique does not have to be, again, you know, like, you know, the goal of critique is not to like tear somebody or some group or something down. It's to, like, strengthen the tools, strengthen what you have. It's to go back out and do it again and try it differently. Because, I mean, what the fuck? It's not like we're free yet. You know what I mean? Like, seriously, I'll critique Harriet Tubman. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I would hope that, you know, poetic license, Harriet Tubman would want me to critique her. You know, working with political prisoners, in particular, like Noah, I used to like tease him and Bashir all the time. Like, you know, what the fuck were you thinking?
Uh-huh.
Like, wow. Did you do this? Did you do that? You know, like engaging in you know, with critique of the level of hindsight. And I would want that critique of me. Like, what the hell were you thinking about? Like, really? Why did you make that decision? What was the logic? What was the logic? You know, that's important. That marks history. And so, like, if you're scared to engage in that, or if you are defensive around engaging in that, then I would argue that you are participating in a capitalist ideology that says, that pushes individualism and pushes this notion of perfectionism and does not allow real change. You know, that's highly capitalist, you know.
There's been sort of like what we used to call in Philly. It was called the call out culture, and I think what happened is like people would be called out for doing something fucked up, and then no one would like talk to them anymore. And I feel like that's like the opposite of what you're saying, because you're saying like it's all about working together and like becoming better, or like in our work, and it's not about us. It's not about you being a bad person because I criticize your work. It's about us working together to make it better, right?
Right. Well, yeah, of course. I mean, I think as an abolitionist, the notion of shaming and blaming and, you know, like, I also think that's capitalist, right? Like, it's punitive. And is that helpful? Like, you're exiling me? You know, you're locking me up? You're putting me out of our movement because I did something that you found to be, and I'm using you in this kind of generalist way, that you, the majority of the movement, or you, this individual in the movement, found to be abhorrent, and yet you cannot deal with me as a, and again, going back to this notion of trust, you can't deal with me as invested in our you know, our collective worldview. Like, you're going to make a decision about whether or not I'm invested. Like, I'm not at all talking about that. I think that's harmful, and I think that's punitive. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how do we as a movement move and actually come to a point where we reach liberation. And, I mean, I think, like, even, like, at the social forum, you know, like, I felt like, wow, what the fuck are people talking about? Let's go. It's 5 o'clock. I'm done. Like, really?
At that particular meeting, yeah.
You know, I mean, I was like, what we're making, we're engaging in a historic moment. And
yeah.
I mean, I thought about, like, you know, W.B. Du Bois and Frederick Douglass, and, you know, I thought about the Niagara conventions and various conventions where people come together to mark a moment in history. And they're coming together from all these different walks of life. And they have these politics and you know, principles that they are, you know, hoping to infuse in our collective movement. And you engage. It's like you engage. You engage one another. Because in the process of engaging one another, like, we are in the process of you know, participating in this moment of growth. And that's the thing about the Philly stuff. It's like, shit, like I said, I mean, you know, making that dude cry, you know, like I went outside with him and I was like, you know, what are you talking about? Like, explain what you see, because I don't see that. And here's my analysis. Here's where I see it. What do you see? And I'm not going to just, like, accept what you're saying. I want to struggle with you on this. And this is not about you as a freaking individual. And I don't care if you cry. You know, you put this out here. Let's go. And then we can have coffee. But we can go out for drinks, and I can get to know you personally, and you can get to know me personally. But as we're engaging in our struggle, like, what is it that we're bringing to the table, you know? And I don't see that as harmful. I see that actually useful. And I feel like I grew, and I feel like hopefully he grew, and I feel like those of us who participated in those struggles leading up to August 1st and the whole thing grew, whether or not the cops stomped us or not. That's like such a bullshit, not relevant point. Because of course they did, you know?
Like, right. Oh my God.
And if that's the measure of whether this was a success or not, then yeah, we fucking lost. That's not my measure.
Wow, yeah. The transformation that we all went through.
Yeah, and that's not to say, and that's, I'm not being, like, Pollyannish about it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm really not, like, trying to, like, put a, you know, and then they all live happily ever after kind of swing on it. I'm just really saying, like, that was, you know, it was hard as shit. It was horrible being in Philly for 3 weeks when I didn't live there. It was horrible doing that work. It was hard doing those struggles with folks. It was hard, right? But, you know, okay, dialectics, and then what? What else was it? You know, like, really? There was more to that.
I think a lot can be learned from that, from R2K, and, like, I'm really excited. Is there anything else in particular that you'd want to talk about R2K in particular?
I mean, funny stories.
Yeah.
You know, like, when we found out that the Puppet House had been raided. And I think we were one of the Puppet House was supposed to be the first. They were supposed to come out first. And we had Quadrant 1, and we were supposed to go, and freaking George Bush Sr. was going into the hospital in our quadrant, right? And so,
oh, wow.
Yeah, right. And it's majority people of color, and like, this is going to be fun. And the Puppet House got raided, but, like, I was doing Castico, and I had told the squad, like, all right, you know, here's some, okay, lesson learned. This is stupid. It is, like, totally stupid. Here's the code, right? When I put my hand in my hair, that means go. And if I put my hand in my back pocket, that means stop. We got our code, right? Right. And so, don't go. And so, me and my communications person, who I will not name because I don't know what he wants, if he wants public attention around this. But my communications person, each tactical person was working with a communications, a comms person.
So, that's right. I did comm, yeah.
You did comm?
I was doing comm, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, my comm person, or the person I was working with, my comm person, he is my comm person, but the person I was doing comm with, he got word that, because I think we were supposed to go, like, right after the puppets came out, you know? And
right.
He got word that there had been a raid. And so he's like, you know, there's been a raid. And we're standing on some kind of incline, and we see all these cops on bikes, which I always thought was the most ridiculous shit ever, like organizing themselves. I know how the Philly cops be on bikes and stuff. But they were organizing, they were bike brigade, you know, and everybody's getting in order, getting in position. And my comm person is like, Puppet House got raided. I was like, what? No, check that out. Like, what? You know, and he's like, 70 people arrested. I'm like, no, check that out further. Check that out. Is that a rumor? What's up? Like, what's up? What? And so the Frank squad, like, looking at me, you know, like, there's a time, what's going on? There's a time, we're ready to go. We want to wreak havoc in the city of Philly. And the Republicans on the bus, you know, what's up? he communicates back, no, it's really true. They got raided, 70 people arrested. And we don't know what to do next. There's no communication. Communication's getting shut down. We don't know what to do next. And I'm like, oh, fuck, oh, shit. And I put my hand in my hair because, like, that's what I do.
Oh.
And they take off. And I'm like, oh, no.
Oh.
I take off after them. I put my hand in my back pockets and jump it over that. Stop. Like, so ridiculous.
Oh my god.
It was so ridiculous. So that little action that the cops did just kind of got us. We didn't, you know, we did not move according to plan. And so, you know, again, lessons learned or lessons reinforced. It's like, you know, you gotta be flexible, right? And so you have all these great plans and, you know, shit changes. And if you can't, I always say, like, you know, revolution is like jazz. You know what I mean? It's like, you better be spontaneous with yours or else improv, or else you're done. And so, like, It took us a minute. We kind of wandered about, like, what to do now, you know? And then I think just out of sheer boredom, it wasn't just that simple. That's the human part of it. The human part of it is we were bored out of our skull, and it was hot, and we were wandering the streets of Philly in our quadrant, and there were no cops around, and we had stuff. You know, we had piano wire, we had tack, we had shit. So it's like, now why aren't we using this? It was like, yeah, let's just force. And we started, and other Black Bloc had already come through and done their thing. You know, every place we arrived, Black Bloc had already beat us to it. Okay, other people had this idea too. And so before long, you know, people were just kind of doing havoc, and it wasn't necessarily going according to, I don't know what other affinity groups had planned, but, you know, it totally didn't go along. We totally had a different plan, and yet, you know, we were able to, you know, do a lot of what we had come to do. So we definitely stopped various movement, and, you know, That was fun. It was good. It really was fun.
Yeah. It's inspiring.
Watching the Republicans on the bus was the best. Like, we got to the bus,
they were scared of you, huh?
this year. And this one cop, I remember one cop in one of our crime squad teams, a woman who you know, whose name I won't say, was doing her thing, her and somebody else, and the cop was like, "You're gonna get arrested. You better put that down. You're gonna get arrested. You're gonna get arrested." And she was like, "Yeah, come on." The piano wired it up and kept it moving. The cop was like unable to chase them because he couldn't move and he was slow. And they were just like, they teased him for a bit and then they did their thing and kept it moving. It was, it was a day of wildness, and that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought that we were going to keep having actions like that, but it kind of died out a bit, the big convergences, which, I mean, maybe it wasn't tremendously strategic to just always have these big convergences, but I was looking forward to maybe, like, refining, you know, us refining our skills in those things and gaining ground. But I remember that day I was doing comm, and I was at this intersection that I was with a group of people that locked down on the on-ramp on the highway that went down to where the convention was happening. And they successfully held it for a few hours, and I was there. And I remember when you all came, when the flying squad came, and you were asking me where they were because you couldn't see them. And I was so, like, it's all about, like, the codes and everything, and, like, I was so afraid of pointing. And, of course, the police knew they were there, but I was, like, I was sort of trying to gesture with my little finger, like, they're over there. And you were like, where are they?
I was like, I was my flying squad.
Oh. Oh my God! Did they leave? Did they leave that spot without you or something? Or?
No. I told you I was on my own. I was like, oh shit, go ahead, you go, I'll catch you.
Oh God! I'm almost 40 myself. Oh God!
Wow.
So I remember one person, Chris. You know, we ended up, I don't know where, but we ended up kind of in this crowd, and Chris was all hyped. And Chris was like, I'm going to take this dumpster. I'm going to take this dumpster. I was like, no, don't do this. Don't do this now. And he was like, no, I'm going to take this dumpster. Why not? Blah, blah, blah. I was like, stop arguing with me. I'm tactical. I'm the fucking leader. And he was like, you know, why can't I do it? It doesn't make sense. I'm like, because it doesn't feel safe to me. It's not good. It doesn't feel right. We're too insular, da-da-da-da. We don't know who's around us. No, I don't suggest we do that. And he kept arguing with me. I was like, fuck it, Chris. Do it. Do whatever you want. And so he took it. He took the dumpster. He turned the dumpster over, right? And, like, some tie-dye, hippie-looking guy, a cop, nabbed him immediately. And then another comrade who I don't know if he wants to be identified because he didn't get locked up, he's, like, trying to unarrest him. I'm like, no, let's go. We got to go. Hey, Chris, I love you. I'll be working for you from the outside.
Oh,
I told you. I was the leader.
Oh,
but
shit,
he did such great work inside.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that he was there. I remember another comrade, like, we had, who you know, part of SLAM, one of our more paranoid members, you know, you know, the cops were watching us, right? You know, I mean, like, the cops have been watching all of us, particularly those of us who have been part of the organizing crew. Like, you know, there were pictures and they would be standing outside taking pictures when we go into meetings and that sort of shit, right? But when folks arrived, I think a lot of these particular comrades were, they were staying in a church. I don't know if you know this story. I'm trying not to give up individual identities. They were staying in a church, and you know, the cops were like staying across the street from them and making no secrets that they were being watched. I mean, that's, you know, part of an intimidation tactic, right? So they let you know they're watching you. And so they would, like, sit in the window with binoculars and shit like that, you know. And then some of us were staying at someone's house, and she had a pretty, she lived in a pretty middle-class neighborhood, and, you know, helicopters were always hovering, and, you know, they were clearly watching us, right? And, but anyway, he found out, I mean, he understood that he was being watched, that they were being watched. And so, you know, we had these little, I still have these, we had these little laminated maps of the quadrant, you know?
Yeah, I have mine, yeah.
You have yours? All right. Those, you should love those up. Those were the coolest things.
Yeah.
So blow those up for the, I know, I love mine too. Blow them up for the show or something.
Yeah.
Those are pretty cool. So, you know, but everybody didn't have laminated ones. Some people had, like, just, we had also made copies. So some people had stuff in, you know, on paper. And so, and there were notes and things like that. And so he found out that, you know, he assumed, rightfully so, that they were being watched. And so he started eating this paper.
Oh, the laminated one? Oh,
yeah,
God.
The laminated one, the paper one. And plus he shit notes down the toilet. You know, someone contacted me. I was like, what the fuck are you doing?
Oh, jeez.
But, you know, can you imagine?
I ate some phone numbers.
See? This is what I'm saying. Being like, you know, how old were you then?
26.
Okay, so you were 26. Some folks were a little younger than you, being in, like, some a little older. But, you know, being in this kind of, like, high-pressured environment and having the police, like, you know, really, really intimidating you, you know. You know, that's scary. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It was really, I don't know, I think it was a real coming of age. I think for all of us, you know, not just the young ones, but the older ones too. It was pretty scary. It was pretty good. Because it taught us a lot. You know, about, like, the state and about what the state was capable of and blah, blah, blah. And, like, hats off to everybody for still saying, I don't care. This is still relevant. And, like, I'm going to do this anyway. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Hats off to those parents who were freaking out. But did not, like, for the most part, a lot of the parents did not say to their kids, like, as I recall, the ones I talked to, like, you did something wrong. Like, you know, the parents that I remember having communication with just wanted their kids to be okay. They might have wanted their kids to, like, go ahead and cop a plea, come home. But they didn't say to the kids, like, shame on you. You know, the ones, again, I could say the majority of the ones that I talked to did not do that. And it's pretty powerful. So
that's great.
Yeah. So those are my stories. I think I probably have more, but I have talked you and me and anybody listening into serious, like, sleep mode now.
No, I love it. I'm just thrilled we got to get to cover so much ground, you know?
Let me just say this last thing. Now, do you remember when we got back to Slam? We had chains.
Do, do you mean when people were really pissed at us for, like, why did you want to do this thing in Philly and now we're so behind on everything?
And we had in the back office, like, every piece of evidence possible.
Oh.
We had chains and piano wires, other shit in the back office of the
year. Yeah, right. Oh, my God. I'm student government. And they're... Oh, my God. I remember being afraid they would raid our office.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was so, the level of fear.
And the level of fear, and we had all of the evidence.
We should have raided. What were they thinking?
I know.
I mean, the New York Red Squad was already after us.
I know.
Jeez.
Wow. I know. And people were like, we got to get rid of this. We, you know, it was pretty hectic. And I agreed. I'm like, why do we have all this evidence?
Oh, my God.
I think I had, like, handcuff keys.
Uh-huh.
Lovely.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's good. I think, I'm really excited about what, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now looks like with, you know, from Kazembe to you to, you know, I don't know, Liam to everybody, mm-hmm. Michelle, everybody, Sandra, Lenina doing, Chris, everybody doing something that is, really pushing boundaries and also like the passion that we had. And I hope all this is, I don't know, all this probably don't need to be in the interview, but the passion that we have is so, so raw and so honest, and it really, really, really is an, you know, it's just, it makes me so proud and so honored. Jed, to be, like, connected and part of y'all, you know, part of us.
Yeah.
And we were fabulous, you know?
Yeah.
And we still are.
Yeah.